Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and legacy of Isaac Bashevis Singer. An immigrant to the United States, Singer was an esteemed essayist, short story writer, novelist, translator, and children's book author. As a young man in Poland, Singer initially pursued rabbinical studies, but the pull of literature was too strong. He worked as a journalist while honing his storytelling skills. After immigrating to the U.S. in 1935, Singer contributed to the Jewish Daily Forward, a Yiddish-language newspaper which published much of his fiction. The events of World War II heightened the poignancy of Singer's work. He wrote in Yiddish and celebrated Polish-Jewish resourcefulness and imagination, a language and culture nearly wiped out by the Holocaust. In 1978, he won the Nobel Prize in Literature for, quote, his impassioned narrative art, which, with roots in Polish-Jewish cultural tradition, bring universal human conditions to life, end quote. For this episode, we are joined by writer and scholar Alon Stephans, editor of the Library of America's three-volume collection of Singer's work. Alon is also the editor of the forthcoming anthology, A Nation Wrestles with God, American Prophets, Philosophers, and Firebrands, in which Singer is included. This book and this episode are presented in conjunction with our current special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. Alon also served as an advisor on this exhibit, which is on display now at the American Writers Museum. Alon is interviewed by Nate King, content and exhibits manager at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place May 18th, 2026, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Alon, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers.
It's such a pleasure to be with you.
I'm looking forward to chatting with you. We've worked with you a lot on a lot of many projects here at the American Writers Museum. So one of which being our current special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, of which Isaac Bashevis Singer, who we're here to talk about today, is featured in and inspired a lot of the sort of early workings of how we put that exhibit together and the angle we took. So all of that is to say, excited to get into this conversation with you, but I was wondering if you could introduce yourselves to our listeners a little bit.
With pleasure. I am Alon Stephans, born in Mexico in the early 60s. Yiddish was my first language, just as Yiddish was the first language of Isaac Bashevis Singer. I am the grandchild of Eastern European immigrants who crossed the Atlantic running away from pogroms and anti-Semitism and poverty. Singer would have been the generation of my grandparents, thereabouts. And as a Yiddish reader and as a Yiddish speaker, from early on was given some of his short stories and novels by one grandmother in particular who had them, and then found others in the library and fell in love with them. I'm also a professor and a translator from different languages, and I am the co-founder and publisher of Restless Books, which actually to coincide with the wonderful exhibit that the museum, the American Writers Museum has, is bringing out an anthology called A Nation Wrestles with God, American Prophets, Philosophers, and Firebrands. And it also includes Singer in it.
Yeah, yeah, we're very much looking forward to that book. When's the publication date again?
The pop date is the 26th or 27th of June. But we're going to do an event in the American Writers Festival where we're going to launch the book, the anthology.
June 7th. That'll be at the Harold Washington Library Center in downtown Chicago with Reza Aslan, so it should be a fantastic, and Emily D. Cruz from the University of Chicago. So it should be a great conversation, and it'll kick off the book and also the festival for us. So we're excited for it.
Really excited.
Yeah, and so I guess maybe now we have A Nation Wrestles with God that you edited. You've mentioned Singer's Yiddish stories you were given to as. So I'm curious how you see your own sort of career trajectory. Either did you see yourself following Singer or sort of being led down certain roads by him?
I am an early devotee of Singer. I was mesmerized as a young man with his style, with the way he structured his stories. And coming from Yiddish, a language that is about 1,000 years old, but only in the past 2,200 years has it become a literary language. I was hypnotized by the fact that you could do what he did in that language in such a modern and cosmopolitan and open way. Zinger was a very controversial writer. I did not know that early on at the beginning when I started reading him. But as I went from simply reading a short story or happening on one of his novels to really studying him more in full, I realized that there was a very complex human being here, an immigrant, a rationalist, a trailblazer in many ways that inaugurated a new way of looking at Yiddish and Jewish culture from the perspective of having arrived to the United States and presenting it in under a light that had not been seen before. I also love the fact that Singer had remained loyal to his language, Yiddish, but that as time went by, became fluent in English and co-translated some of the stories or the novels. And that idea of self-translation or co-translation, which in him became even more complicated, we can talk about it as we move along, is also one that intrigues me very much. What is the role of the author, who is in charge of translating their own work? Can they be objective? Can they really present it in a neutral way? And so it's the relationship that he had with his many translators, from the Japanese to the South Americans. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, that was an interesting part. I think it was one of your essays. It might be Singer's Typewriter and Me, that essay, but you do mention that as well, that the process he had with his translators of
Right.
yeah, maybe you could tell.
Yeah.
I thought that was fascinating.
He came to the United States in 1935. He was at that time 33 years old. He was already a published author. He had published his first book after much difficulty in Warsaw, but because of the rise of fascism in Europe and of Nazism, particularly in Germany, he had to run away. His older brother had already made it to the United States. His older brother, Israel Joshua Zinger, was also a writer, a terrific writer, and I think even a better novelist than Bashevis was. And upon arriving to the United States, Zinger needed first and foremost to survive. So he started writing in Yiddish in as many opportunities as he could, in whatever way he could. And I say this because he landed, thanks to his brother, on a job at the Jewish Daily Forward, which was the major Yiddish newspaper of the time. And I think to this day, one of the most successful immigrant newspaper publications ever to come out from this country. And he published under pseudonyms, under a variety of pseudonyms. Certain editions could have three or four articles by Zinger, one with his name and the other three with a variety of the pen names or pseudonyms that he had. But then he also realized, Nate, that Yiddish was not going to take him very far if he wanted to be a successful writer in the United States, because it was a language of such a small group of immigrants, and it was a group of people that were traumatized by the experience of hatred in Europe. So he needed to, he wanted to be a broad, worldly writer. He started to teach himself English, but it was already in his 30s, and learning a third or a fourth language in your 30s is not as easy as it is in other moments in life. And yet he did as best as he could. And then over the next few years, he started devising methods whereby he could translate with different people who did not know Yiddish. So many of his translators, this is really a flabbergasting, many of his translators did not know Yiddish. They would come to his apartment, he would read the text in Yiddish, and on the fly, translated into English. They would type it or take notes, then they would go home, shape it in a better way, and come back, and they would work together on it. So his first attempt was preliminary. They would embellish it, and then there would be a collaboration between the two. And he called the English versions the second originals for that purpose, meaning that they were coming from the author too. They were authoritative, but they were not the Yiddish. And what he did is that in that process of reading and in polishing as he on the fly as he went on, he would sometimes kind of eliminate a character or improve on certain parts. So it was more than translation. It was rewriting in an oral way. It's a very interesting, controversial, because they didn't know Yiddish, and he didn't know English perfectly. And also because he was a womanizer, and many of the translators were women, and the translation was only the first step to a relationship that he might have with them. And second, because oftentimes, as one can see in the archives that are now at the Ransom Center at the University of Texas in Austin, he did not pay the translator for the work that they had done. So those are the secrets that one finds when one writes a biography or studies an author. That can be very interesting, but can have kind of a dark side.
Yeah, that's very interesting indeed. And it also makes me think too of like he's almost choosing the audience, or potential audience sort of dictates the language, and then thus the story can change too as for the audience as well.
Absolutely. I think what we get with Singer is that it's not only what pops up in the imagination of the author, but how that imagination needs to be tailored to the language, to the audience that is going to be receiving it. He was traumatized, as many immigrants are who come from a certain educational background, at the quote-unquote contaminated level of Yiddish that people were using on the streets. For him, it wasn't really Yiddish, poor Yiddish, beautiful Yiddish, the Yiddish of his background, etc. But he called it Yinglish, a mixture of Yiddish and English. And that, he said, was going to ultimately throw Yiddish to the dogs. And he wanted to preserve Yiddish, but he also wanted to reflect some of those changes. So he lived in that duality of how to do both.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. Well, maybe now's a good time. You've kind of mentioned a little bit, but so you have worked on a biography forthcoming. Maybe you can give our listeners a very quick rundown of his bio. You're born in Poland, right?
Right. Bacheli Singer was born in Poland, the second of four children. His oldest sister was also a writer and was a trailblazer who wanted to do something that had not been done before, become one of the a member of a generation of Jewish Yiddish-speaking women that could write novels and fiction in general. But ironically, it was her mother, Batsheva Zinger's mother too, Batsheva, who put the most obstacles, thinking that a woman should stay at home, should be a take care of the family and the kids. And so there was a lot of tension between mother and daughter, and the daughter ultimately left the family, moved to Belgium, where she married. The marriage lasted just a few years. She had a child, and she lived in poverty and distant from the family, and still continued writing. Her name was Esther Kreitman. The second son was the Israel Yehoshua Zinger, this wonderful writer too, and who was much more famous than Bashevis during their lifetime. But his brother died at the age of 44 when Bashevis, just a few years after he had arrived to the United States. And Bashevis, the third child, always lived under the shadow of his older brother, and even said that he suffered of some writer's block because all the attention was going in the direction of his brother. And then there was a fourth Moshe, a fourth child who died in the Holocaust with the mother in one of the concentration camps. The father died of illness before the Holocaust took place. Bashevis came to the United States in, as I said, in the first half of the 30s. He was very well read. He had very high aspirations. He was of a generation of Yiddish writers that wanted to go beyond stereotypes and certain kind of tropes in that literature that he felt were preventing it from becoming truly international, truly European. He wanted to be like a European writer that just happened to write in Yiddish. And it was part of a larger modernist generation. He faced all kinds of obstacles. He had only, I think, $58 when he arrived to the United States. He arrived, I should say this, without documents. He was an undocumented immigrant. Important statement in this day and age when there seems to be a war on those that are coming, as if they are going to take over everything that we have done and undermine our civilization. But this man ultimately won the Nobel Prize in 1978 and was a superb writer, imitated and adored by many others. He started finally writing again in Yiddish when his brother died in 1944. First short stories, then a few novels, and ultimately became a very prolific writer of a novel a year, sometimes two novels a year, many short stories that were published. And this is a first in the history of Yiddish literature. He published in Playboy, he published in The New Yorker, in Harper's, in The Atlantic. These were magazines that were not at that time in any way devoted or open to immigrant writing. And so in many ways he's a path opener. He did something that the current generation of immigrant writers is doing very effortlessly, but it was thanks to figures like him that opened the door. He died in the early 90s of dementia. He by then had an apartment in New York, had an apartment in Florida, and was beloved not only for his short stories, his plays, his novels, and his essays, but also for his children's stories. And this is another aspect of Bashevis that is very interesting. He wrote many children's stories, but had one child with whom he hardly talked and didn't spend much time with his grandchildren. So it's interesting to see how good a children's story writer he is without necessarily being in that environment.
Yeah, that is an interesting aspect how it shakes out sometimes the artist, versus the real person too, and like
Exactly, yeah.
the differences in there. Yeah. Well, thanks for that overview. It reminded me of again, I think it must have been I took notes, but for some reason didn't link to the source. But I'm
Yeah.
pretty sure it was Singer's Typewriter and Me. But you
Right.
sort of mentioned how he was kind of unparalleled in the in Yiddish writer before, since having that su such a worldwide impact. And I'm glad you mentioned that he was an immigrant, because I did in that essay also wanted to say I really liked you write. He is, after all, an exemplary case of diasporic literature. Then you go on to say, Singer might have become an American, but he did it in the most elastic sense of the term, using his ethnicity as a springboard.
Yeah. And he kept, in many ways, because he already arrived made at in his 30s, and because when he did the first 15 years, the destruction of European Jewry took place in Bashevis Singer. Most of the he's the most photographed Yiddish writer of all time. And most of his photographs are of him already in his 40s, but mostly 50s and 60s. So in Yiddish, the word for grandfather is Zayde. And he has always in the photographs this demeanor of being everybody's Zayde, it's everybody's grandfather. And I think that what many Americans saw in him was the link to a world that was no more, that he was explaining to them in non-simplistic ways with magic, with the sexuality, eroticism, and he was Americanizing the shtetl, the little village in Eastern Europe, in a way that I think the second and third generation of American Jews, that is the children of the immigrants and the grandchildren, wanted to see. Not a fossilized landscape, but one that was very dynamic, and Zinger was very good at that.
That's it, because you yourself would be in that second or third
I
generation
would be on the
too,
second
right?
or the third
Yeah.
generation. I would maybe I would be on the third generation because
Yeah.
he's the generation of he's the immigrant generation, and I'm the generation of the grandkids. Though that same thing happened to in Mexico where my grandparents arrived, and I reverted the immigrant journey by moving to the United States. Everybody else stayed in Mexico.
Yeah. It's a I like how you put that, because that kind of segues to my another, or maybe even answers it. But how did he gain such a
Yeah.
worldwide popularity? And maybe that everybody's grandfather kind of answers that question.
Yeah, on the one hand, it's that he became everybody's grandfather, or certainly everybody who was a Jew in America, who was thinking of America as a new place of opportunity and as a land of assimilation, saw in Zinger the potential of having roots in the old world, but becoming a very dynamic and cosmopolitan thinker and citizen. On the other hand, I think that his work coincided in the 1960s, in the 1970s, with the hippie anti-establishment generation, with the age of Aquarius, and he is writing about rabbis that have sexual needs, housewives, Jewish housewives that are running away with a neighbor. This is something that is enhancing the picture of the sexuality of a landscape that up until then was seen in a very kind of cardboardy way. And I think that as a result, he coincided that kind of new, revitalized and daring approach, coincided with an America that was getting rid of certain strict protocols, becoming much more liberal in terms of sexuality, in terms of the themes you could talk about. And I think for that reason, through the New Yorker, through Playboy, he kind of greased the entrance of American Jews into a combination of carrying the baggage of the past with you and also adapting it to this new land.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And yeah, timing wise, it all works out. And
Yeah.
yeah, I think it was you describe your grandmother as describing him as a pervert, or
Just that total. My grandmother said, "Come on, Ilan, read this. He's a pervert." And so I love that contradiction of instead of kind of keeping it away from me, she gives it to me, find out who he is, because I think she loved him too. But it had to come with that admonition, be careful here. It can run you in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit. We've sort of been talking about his placement in American letters and the movements that were happening, but I'm curious who he, as a writer before him, was he inspired by, or who did he really look up to?
Well, it's important to put two kind of lines of tradition here. One is, in order to answer your question, one is that not until 1933 did he really get exposed to American literature. So prior to his arrival here, he is, I think it's fair to say, an ignoramus when it comes to American writer. I don't think he had read Hawthorne, although I think Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter would have been a very attractive book to him, or Emily Dickinson or Emerson or the Transcendentalist. He didn't read either any of the writers of the early part of the 20th century. So he arrives in an America that is at that time really being presented by two or three major figures: Hemingway, in Faulkner, in John Dos Passos. It's that raw and rough realism. These are the writers that either are exploring the aftermath of the Civil War in the South, as in the case of Faulkner, in kind of mapping out the tensions between families in this invented town in Mississippi of Napathawpa County, or the Hemingway that goes first as a reporter and then as a novelist to Spain and to Cuba and to other parts of Africa, hunting kind of the American that is brave and very macho, etc. And John Dos Passos that is interested in the corruption of corporations and. So it's not quite his cup of tea. What he's interested in is the mystical religious side. And he starts connecting with American writers that are interested in theology or are interested in the mystical world of God. He is very connected to some of the preachers of the 19th century that are talking about God as a creating a dream in which we all live together. His conviction is that the world itself is a dream and is a dream of God, and that the moment that God wants to stop the world, the dream is going to pop up and disappear. And intriguingly, Nate, there's another writer about whom he knows absolutely nothing, and neither does he does this writer, Jorge Luis Borges from Argentina, who is doing exactly the same thing, almost exactly the same age. Borges never wins the Nobel Prize, but they almost died at the same time. They are kind of parallel lives in a very in very different environments. Borges writes in Spanish, but he reads a lot of American literature. And then Pashevzinger doesn't read any American literature, writes in Yiddish. But the content is very, very similar in many ways. So on the one hand, he has many of the Yiddish writers that are influencing him, Yiddish writers that are talking about golems, which are creatures of made of clay like Frankenstein, or that are talking about possessions, exorcists that take over individuals, and all that just intrigues him very much. And then he enters the American second, the American tradition, and he wants to understand how this country sees God and how God sees the individuals. Because remember, Nate, by 1945, the end of the Second World War, many Jews who had come from a very religious background finished the Holocaust. 6 million people have been killed, wondering where God has been in all this. How could God allow for the decimation of such a big portion of the Jewish people? So the question of a silent God, an absent God, a reluctant, omnipresent or omnipotent, but disengaged is a very central one. And he really asks these questions. What kind of God do we have? And how do we relate to somebody who is silent all the time?
Yeah. Was religion important, either like as a child, as far as like structurally, socially, but yeah,
Yeah,
what was his
he comes from
connection?
a, that's a very good point. He comes from a family where the father, who by all accounts, he, Bashevis Zinger wrote a series of autobiographical volumes. So we know a little bit about his family. And his brother also wrote a book about the family and the destruction of the Eastern European Jewish world. And the father was a rabbi, an itinerant rabbi, who had trouble holding on to jobs. And so would stay temporarily for 3 months as a freelancer in this congregation, and then would move to another congregation and went from one place to another. And again, apparently, he is the one that is le less assertive in, as a parent in the family. And a mother, Batsheva, and it's important her name because Isaac Batsheva Zinger will take her name. Batsheva is transformed into Batsheves, and he's paying tribute to her by adopting that middle name. She is the skeptic, the rationalist. So if the father is interested in all this Kabbalistic, gothic, mysterious creatures like goblins and golems, the mother says, all that is nonsense. We have to live in the modern world. Everything can be explained, cause and consequence. And so there's the tension between the two. And one of the most interesting things about Bashevis Zinger is that you almost hear the two parents talking to each other every time you read him. One side is saying, no, there's no such thing as God. Everything can be explained rationally. And the other part says, rationality just pushes us to the limits and can create destruction. We have to be mystical. We have to have another part. And the tension is never resolved. And thus, I think he becomes a very attractive human writer and human being, because I think ultimately in all of us, that tension is an engine that pushes us forward.
Yeah, the tension and it never being resolved is, yeah,
Right.
you're right. It's, yeah. And 'cause that makes me think of our exhibit, American Prophets. Some of the writers included are writers like Flannery O'Connor, who is, very Catholic and writes about that. And, but other writers are writers I would, think of Singer this way, who are exploratory in their writing and not necessarily dogmatic or trying to convince or sway a reader one way or the other, but is just, going through it personally, and then that comes out in their writing. So I'm glad you mentioned that of, yeah.
I take this opportunity, Nate, to celebrate really the topic of the exhibit of American Prophets and the opportunity to work again with you guys in putting together this volume of A Nation Wrestles with God. Because for a variety of reasons, I think we are often afraid of discussing the topic of God in American literature, which we see as secular literature. And so sometimes bringing together in the same fold Flannery O'Connor and James Baldwin and Bashevis Zinger and Thomas Merton and Abraham Joshua Heschel and others seem to be like either trying to proselytize about religion or trying to enter a realm that supposedly criticizes God and criticizes religion. But what one finds, well, certainly what I did as the editor of this 500-page anthology, is that we have, as a nation, a very complex, nuanced relationship with God, both as individuals and as a collective, as a society as a whole. And that, in fact, even when you study an individual like Bashevis Zinger, you can't really say, well, he had this idea about God and this idea about reason or the intellect, because he lives until his mid-80s and he goes through all kinds of changes in life. So maybe in his 40s he has this approach, but by the 50s he's changing, which is something that happens to all of us. The older you get, the more probably complex certain ideas about the afterlife might or might not become, depending on who you are. And then you revise or return to your childhood or to your adolescence. So I find this really a genuine, very needed topic that needs to be approached honestly and without these forces that are telling us, oh, they are campaigning for us to be religious. I'm less interested in that than in how they bargain with their own personal God.
Yeah, bargain is a good word. Yeah, I know personally I'm excited to for the new anthology, and I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about Singer's entry in the anthology.
Singer's entry in the anthology, it is really a find. It's something unique. Originally, I was thinking of putting something like the short story, Gimple the Fool. It's one of his most famous stories. It's read broadly. It's translated into multiple languages. It has influenced many people. It's a story of a simpleton, a fool that is bullied by the entire shtetl, by the entire community, but he comes out of it stronger and with a clear vision and with a sense that there's a fate and there's a God that is kind of marking and mapping everything out. And then I thought, well, that's a piece that everybody knows. Maybe I'll find one or two other stories. Many of the stories deal with rabbis that become disillusioned with their faiths, or with some kind of sexual act that pushes them to revise the vision that they had of religion. But then a colleague of mine who had been working at the archives sent me a very brief a treatise that Zinger wrote on God, that it's only a page and a half, where he simply lists 7 points of how to think about God that actually don't resolve anything. They don't tell us if you should believe in God or not believe in God, what kind of God, but he simply says God is everything. God is a power that explains it all, but God is silent. God is distant. God is uncommitted. And so we are here in a rather complicated relationship. It's the relationship with somebody who might love us, but we don't really always feel that love. And yet we have to project that love back. And then he stresses again that concept that I was telling you, that life is a dream. It's God's dream. And whenever that dream ends, then life disappears. And I think that that is an image very much from the rabbinical period in the Middle Ages that he has managed to bring into modernity in a very subtle and intelligent way. And I think that people are going to like this little piece in the anthology.
Nice. I'm excited for it. And I'm curious how, if and how his practice of religion, did he practice regularly? And then that was there some sort of routine or ritual that also informed his writing?
Great question. Great question. To the best of my knowledge, he, having been a child and the child of a rabbi, and at one point, mostly as a result of the pressure that his father put on him, having considered going to a rabbinical seminary and becoming a rabbi, gave all that up. And I believe that he did not keep the Sabbath. He did not even go necessarily in the high holidays to the synagogue. Maybe on certain years, depending on the social aspect, he spoke very frequently in synagogues to those audiences, but in a kind of secular way. So this is a man whose religious education had been a foundation, but whose faith had elapsed in some ways and had been turned into an engine of fictional creativity. And my view would be that he prayed through writing. He connected with God as the creator of these creatures and these scenes, but that he could no longer, especially after two of the members of his family died in the Holocaust, make himself go to synagogue and fit into a more traditional pattern of a believer.
Yeah, that kind of makes me think of another quote that I think you pulled in your essay of Singer's, where he's talking about kind of being not feeling like he's in the traditional, the traditionalist, but
Right.
also not necessarily the new. So he had to kind of be, make his own sort of.
Balance the two. Yeah. And he was particularly interested in free will and wondered what it means to live in a world where God supposedly controls fate, and yet we are given the opportunity to be free. And he has a wonderful line, Nate, that says, "We have to believe in free will. We have no choice." And I find it both very humorous and very persuasive, no? It's not as if we're opting for free will. We have to convince ourselves that free will exists.
Yeah, that is a great line. I wanted to also talk a little bit about sort of the role of, writers and artists at large, because when Singer accepted the Nobel in 1978, I believe it was, he
Right.
gives a great speech that the part of it, part of which we pulled to kind of inform and sort of direct American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, the exhibit. And just wanted to read a little bit of the quote and then talk about it, because I think it's really important and kind of does kind of bridges what we are talking about as well. He says, In their despair, a number of those who no longer have confidence in the leadership of our society look up to the writer, the master of words. They hope against hope that the man of talent and sensitivity can perhaps rescue civilization. Maybe there is a spark of the prophet in the artist after all. And then, he goes on to say, I am not ashamed to admit that I belong to those who fantasize that literature is capable of bringing new horizons and new perspectives, philosophical, religious, aesthetical, and even social. In the history of old Jewish literature, there was never any basic difference between the poet and the prophet.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it's such an interesting quote. I celebrate the fact that you guys use it as a portal to analyze and to set the tone of the exhibit. And I think it's a wonderful piece also to understand the life of Singer and of the many writers of that generation. He belongs, let's remember again, he dies in the early 90s. By then, he is in his 80s. He belongs to probably one of the last generations, if not the last, in which literature really was central. I remember as an immigrant finding out that a new book by Saul Bellow or by Bashevis or by Philip Roth had just been published. This is before Amazon, before Kindles, and any other way of literature circulating that wasn't in a printed book. And then I and many others just running to be the first, as in a Harry Potter fever, at a bookstore to be able to read the book right there before the reviews came down,
Yeah.
before you were tarnished by whatever other opinion. Literature's felt central, at least more central than it does today. I think we live at a time of intense distraction, of a very short attention spans, where literature as the main source of creativity has been expanded. Maybe not replaced, but certainly expanded into television, graphic novels, all kinds of visuals that entertain us and maybe also fool us in a variety of ways. And he still saw that connection between the prophet, the biblical prophet, who uses the words, because I think it's very important to kind of pin down the prophet for what that prophet does. Use the word to admonish, use the word to guide, use the word to educate, and as a result, has to be an incredible rhetorician, an incredible and eloquent speaker that will bring people to their senses if they are going in the right direction or in the wrong direction. It is ultimately the word, the tool that they are going to have. And that passes to the biblical poets and the medieval poets and the role of literature as creating alternative universes in the form of novels or in the form of escapism that really enhances and allows civilization to see itself reflected. The image of Hamlet of a mirror up to nature, no, the word or the theater. We are maybe, this is, if he dies in 91, we are close to 30 years after his death or beyond. And books are harder to distribute these days. People read less. I think people read a lot on iPhones and on the internet, but I don't know how many complete a book and how much a book matters the way it did in another time. So in many ways, there's a clarion here by Bashevis of I speak for a time where literature mattered, was grounding, was central, gave us roots. And maybe it can come back, or maybe it's mutating in a way that I am projecting too much anxiety throughout it. But it's certainly, at least in my view, different from what it was.
Yeah, and even for mine, I was born in 1992, so even just in that, it has changed even for me. And because I like what you said, how literature has expanded, but I also feel like somehow expanded and yet compressed or shortened.
Compressed
Like
as well,
there's
absolutely.
options or more
Yeah.
things to read, but there may be, but the length of them and,
You know, I
commitment to them.
remember, Nate, when immigrating to the United States from Mexico, going to the supermarkets and not really able to believe the amount of cereals that I could get on a particular aisle in the supermarket. And at first, that was, oh my God, this is truly the land of plenty. There are so many different flavors, so many different little cartoons on the box, etc. But then you also realize that after a while, you always go to the same two cereals, and those two cereals are going to be your companions. So I think that the abundance that we have today is, on the one hand, a testament to the creativity of people, of showing we can be entertained through television, through movies, through theater, through all kinds of things. And then the realization that a good story is good, probably in any medium, because it needs to have something that captures people's imagination, that makes them think, that makes them stop. And I think literature does that beautifully. And if other media also do it, it's really ultimately the story that matters in telling it well. And Zinger was a master in telling good stories.
Yeah, a good story is timeless too, right? Like,
Absolutely, yes.
yeah.
You can base it in every detail right now, giving dates and the fashion, but it's timeless because it can be read at any time, and it's the emotions that make us all universal. So it could, in 100 years, people are still going to identify with that envy or jealousy or rivalry. Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to ask real quick. I mean, kind of mentioned it throughout the overall podcast, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on what Singer has meant to you, personally and also
Yeah.
professionally. But like, yeah, just as a human being in the world, how does Singer help you out?
For me, Singer has been both a source of admiration, awe, celebration of the act and art of immigration. For me, Singer, other people see him differently, but for me, I'm an immigrant. I moved from one country to another, I moved from one language to another, and I can say without hesitation that the fracturing that immigration results in one's life, the before and after, the once I spoke Spanish all the time and now I speak English most of the time, is very dramatic. It colors your dreams. It colors the way you relate to others. And Zinger is a master in showing what immigrants that are forced to leave a particular environment do in order to survive in that new environment and define and change that environment in the process. It's not only what America did to them, but what they did to America that ultimately was so fruitful and so full of possibility. And I think that that's what immigrants do all the time, and that's why figures that are bedeviling the immigrants worry me so much, because it's ultimately, if we're talking about how to disseminate stories, I think the first and most durable disseminator of stories is the immigrant, the one that travels to another place and tells a story about departure and return. You have it in the Odyssey, you have it in Gilgamesh, you have it in so many. It's the one that left and then returns, or something is written about that individual that tells you something about the return. So I find it fascinating. I also think that Zinger belongs to a time, Nate, that is very different from ours, where the relationship between men and women could be very abusive. He was not always very kind to the women that translated him or that did work with or for him. So I think there's a certain abuse in him that I find repellent. And I am, like all of us, a byproduct of the Me Too movement and of everything that has happened after the early 90s. The world is very different. Many of the things that Singer did at that time would not be able to happen right now. And yet the stories would still be lasting in different ways. So I think it's important, in my view, not to idealize the writer and turn the writer into a perfect example of life. I think that writers, all of us are imperfect, and it's in our imperfections, how we handle those imperfections, that ultimately we can or not leave a mark or inspire somebody else to see an aspect of life that was not fully explored in a particular way. And I think that Zinger, when seen in that perspective, a man who had a lot of demons to work with, both positively and negatively, and in the end produced 325 incredible short stories, wonderful novels, wonderful children's stories, that you can kind of fit him and see what really genius can be. Genius is not working in isolation. Genius is working in the environment and in your against your own worst parts.
That was well said. Thank you for that, Alon. And I have to ask, this might be a gotcha question, but if of the 325, what's your favorite Singer short story?
Great. I tell you exactly 325 because I edited the three volume collected short stories of Bashevis Zinger for the Library of America. And he, together with Nabokov, Vladimir Nabokov, were the first two non-America born American writers who were being included by the Library of America in the canon, in the national canon, which is a major deal, not arriving here from another language and then and yet being accepted. There are many, as in the case of Neruda, who also wrote many, many poems and who I have loved and read consistently, there are many poems by Neruda that are really bad, really, really bad, but there are 10 or 15 that are enough to justify the existence of the Spanish language. In that's enough. And in the case of Bashevis, it's something similar. 325 is a lot of short stories, but Gimple the Fool is a masterpiece. There's a short story called The Manuscript about a man who writes a manuscript that needs to be rescued when the Germans are just arriving, and it is all done by his mistress who can't stand him anymore. That is an incredible story. And then there's a story called The Cafeteria, kind of a woman who is a neurotic who survived the Second World War, came to New York. It frequently goes to cafeterias where she meets a character that is based in Bashevis. It's a writer who tells stories and who one day tells him that she has seen Hitler in one of the cafeterias. And the main writer says this is impossible. Hitler died, etc. And the story really leaves you in such a wonderful place because the cafeteria burns down mysteriously and nobody knows what was the cause. It could have been some neo-Nazi groups participating in it. And so it's the announcement of a new type of politics that are coming in America in the 1990s that would ultimately become more central in the Trump years, first term, second term. But you feel it kind of palpitating. A typical short story by Bashevis Zinger starts with two people talking, just schmoozing, not saying anything. They haven't seen each other for a long time. And then one of them tells the other, "But you gotta tell me what you meant when we last saw each other about this." And that becomes the trigger to tell one adventure that will push you to the past. The main story will take place in the past. And then you come back to the present at the very end and you realize that there's something that has yet to be resolved. And something happens at the end that twists the entire story. It's a very Edgar Allan Poe approach or a Melville approach. And it's always masterfully done. It sometimes can be in a bad story, short story by Zinger, you feel like you're seeing the strings being pulled, as in a puppet show. But when it's done well, as in these stories that I'm telling you, The Cafeteria and The Manuscript and Gimple the Fool, there's another one about a woman who grows a beard. That is a wonderful story. When it's done well, you don't forget that story.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they're a joy to read, and I definitely recommend listeners get the that three volume collection.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, it's great. As we're getting close to the end here, Alon, was there anything else about Singer or your own work that we haven't touched on that you wanted to cover?
Well, I'd love to say that I'm intrigued by how a writer might or might not become a classic, might not enter that kind of limbo or that very exclusive group of writers that are constantly reread by generations. Bacheva Singer by now has been read by several generations, and it's a part and parcel of the curriculum. At the same time, we are facing all these challenges that we were talking about of literature not being as popular and widespread. So I want to know what the next generation of followers of Bashevis is going to be. Have we reached a moment where certain views of the past about the Holocaust, about the role of the immigrant in America have changed, that the model of Bashevis is no longer feasible? Or instead, as I think, the genius of Singer is always to present this stereotype or prototype or archetype of the immigrant or of the traveler in a way that will perennially be inviting people to read. I think that it's foolish to take for granted the fact that somebody is constantly read, because there are writers who have been classics that were stopped from reading. I'm thinking, for instance, Uncle Tom's Cabin was a book that everybody read during the Civil War, everybody read during the 20th century, and in the 21st century, doesn't seem to me that many people are reading. It has certain representations of the slave that make people uncomfortable. So it's interesting to see what lasts, how things last, and to what degree Zinger with 5 or 10 or 15 or 325 short stories might or might not be carried over to the next generation.
Yeah, that is interesting to think about, and lucky that we have folks like you to, to remind us and continue to
I
work
appreciate it.
uplift Singer's work. So, yeah, I and the biography is there a publication date for that
Yeah, the
yet?
biography I've been writing for, I think, 8 years. A biography of Singer. I've gone to Poland. I've gone to Argentina. I've gone to visit all the places in New York where he was. And it's done. And I am sending the manuscript. You and I are talking right now in the latter part of May. So at the end of this month, it will go to the editor. Hopefully, it will be a 2027 book.
Nice.
We will see. But I'm happy and exhausted at the same
I
time.
bet. I bet. Yeah. And well, that also your, A Nation Wrestles with God
That's
also
right.
comes out. Can you remind me again, June?
It comes out on June 27th.
June 27th. And then on June 7th, you can see Alon along with Reza Aslan at the American Writers Festival here in Chicago, hosted by us and the Chicago Public Library. So we're looking forward to that. And thank you again for joining me today, Alan.
This was wonderful, wonderful. Talking about Zinger and good literature, what else is there that is attractive? Thank you, Nate, very much. And thank you to the American Writers Museum that is keeping the treasure trove of good literature alive and spreading the word and bringing people to see these writers and to read. Hats off to you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Nation of Writers, part of the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.